Mens rea is the legal principle of intent that must be proved in a number of crimes, such as murder. It means literally, the guilty mind. The Mens rea podcast explores the most notorious crimes from Ireland and the UK, and the court cases that followed. Every fortnight, a new case is discussed. So if you like hard-hitting, in-depth true crime podcasts, head on over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from and subscribe to the Mens rea podcast today.
They Walk Among Us is an award-winning true crime podcast. From the sinister and surreal to the brutal and bizarre, join us to hear more on the UK's most notorious and obscure crimes. Featuring well-known cases like the life and crimes of the UK's most violent inmate, Charles Bronson, to the sad tale of the Gibbons twins whose string of petty crimes would lead them to be trapped in Broadmoor for 11 years before their eventual release ended in tragedy. We also cover lesser-known cases like the woman who murdered a husband with an ornamental frog and kept him mummified in her shed for 18 years, or the teenager that used his elaborate online fantasy life to plot his own murder. Listen and subscribe to They Walk Among Us through Acast, Apple Podcasts, or your favourite podcast provider.
Southern Fraud True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. I would like to emphasize that this episode will deal with graphic violence against children that listeners may find distressing, so please proceed with caution. There are some crimes that shake almost everyone. We watch the news, read every article. We are both mesmerized and outraged, because it's the most unexpected monster, the one you are supposed to feel safe with. It's what we call the family annihilator. A perfectly normal husband and father, actually statistically upper middle class with a lot of responsibility. Men who project the facade of being loving and engaging husbands and fathers. He smiles broadly with his picture-perfect family on Facebook. They look so happy. He looks so happy, outwardly. Then one day, seemingly out of nowhere, he destroys their entire family, often taking his own life and even killing their pets. But some choose to live and continue to protest their innocence despite so much damning evidence, and that's a distinct characteristic of the ones that do not kill themselves. They either confess right away or they never ever tell the truth. There is no middle ground. That's where Jeffrey McDonald sits, former doctor and Green Beret, and also brutal murderer that bludgeoned and stabbed his pregnant wife and two young daughters to death. Disgustingly, he not only continues to swear on his innocence, but has repeatedly wasted time and taxpayers' money with his failed attempts to get out of jail. However, after almost 50 years, he may finally be out of legal options. Welcome to episode 28, The Narcissistic Family Annihilator, Jeffrey McDonald. Whenever there is another horrific case of a family annihilator in the news, like Chris Watts from Colorado, I always think of the McDonald case. It was the first true crime story that really moved me. Crime and all its ugly vagaries are fascinating to most of us, but there is something intrinsically shocking about the family annihilator. I, like many of you, am following the Watts murders with sad but voyeuristic interest. I think it is the averageness of it that makes it so sensational. He looks like any man I scroll past in my news feed on a given day. Ordinary. Normal. But he's not, and that's why we're obsessed. And especially given that Chris Watts murdered his pregnant wife and two preschool-aged daughters, I immediately thought of Jeffrey McDonald and his pregnant wife and daughters. Chris Watts slaughtered his family in the year 2018, with DNA and technology making it almost impossible to get away with it. Not that he was hiding it well anyway, but once he was caught, he confessed pretty quickly. Though recent court filings would indicate that this monster actually intends to blame his dead wife. Jeffrey McDonald murdered his family on a cold, rainy night in February of 1970. There was no such thing as DNA testing then. He was an upstanding, respected citizen, a doctor, and a Green Beret. He thought people would never believe he did it. He actually thought he would get away with it. And he almost did. It took almost a decade to bring him to justice. But let's go back. Back to a cold, rainy night in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Back to Fort Bragg, the same Army base featured in Episode 4, The Third Time's the Charm. If you haven't listened to that episode, I would go back after you've heard the McDonald case. That episode is about another killer from Fort Bragg who almost got away with it. The trials of Timothy Hennis were most certainly influenced by the McDonald case. It was a suspected copycat case immediately, even before that family's babysitter was found to be a McDonald groupie. But I suppose, to be fair, we're all kind of groupies to this case. When young, beautiful mothers and their children are killed, we respond. Our responses are dramatic and almost Pavlovian in their fury. So let's take a look at the infamous McDonald murders, why Jeffrey McDonald's charade almost worked, and how it would be such a different story now, not only with modern technology, but with modern understanding of the monsters in our homes. Fort Bragg is the largest military base in the world, connected to not one but three army towns, with all the crime and general unruliness that tends to pop up in these areas. Fayetteville, however, has a lot of history and antebellum charm. Regardless, there was a definite hippie community and drug culture that fringed the base and seedier areas in the city in the late 60s and 70s. Fort Bragg is less than 10 miles from downtown Fayetteville. But Fort Bragg, then and now, is a good place to be stationed. It's a respected and revered military base, with no less than the Airborne Special Forces centered there. In 1970, Captain Jeffrey McDonald was a young Army doctor living on base. He was born in Queens in 1943, the middle child of Mac and Dorothy McDonald, with a brother named Jay and a sister named Judy. He was raised on Rhode Island, where he met Colette Stevenson in the seventh grade. They dated briefly in high school. She was the only daughter of Freddie and Mildred Kassab. Jeffrey McDonald went on to excel in high school. At graduation, he was voted most popular and most likely to succeed. He was the veritable golden boy, president of his senior class and captain of the football team, with grades earning him a full ride to Princeton. At Princeton, he started seeing Colette again. By September of 1963, Colette was pregnant. Like a lot of young people in this situation, they were very nervous to tell their parents. They were so young and still in college. They told Jeffrey's mother first, and she called to warn Colette's parents that the young couple was on their way to tell them. They watched as Jeff and Colette sat nervously in the car before walking up to the door. Jeffrey told Mildred and Freddie himself and asked for Colette's hand in marriage. Colette Stevenson had an older brother named Robert, but she was the fourth baby girl her mother had given birth to. The other babies, all also named Colette, had been stillborn. Colette was the daughter that Mildred had always dreamed of, and she adored her. Colette was a shy but lovely blonde who was smart as a whip, with a very kind and loving nature. Alfred Kassab had met and married Mildred when Colette was 13 and her brother was 17. Colette's father suddenly and unexpectedly killed himself about a year earlier, throwing her family into chaos. Her mother was working as an interior designer when she met Fred Kassab, who was in the process of divorcing his first wife and had no children of his own. Freddie happily raised Colette as his own daughter. He wasn't as close to her brother Bobby, who was practically grown when his mother remarried, but they still had a great relationship. But Colette was different. She was younger and embraced Freddie as her own father, one she needed so badly after the trauma of her real father's suicide. Freddie would later say that there were really only two things in his life that mattered, Mildred and Colette. He was protective of his stepdaughter, and he thought he knew Jeffrey McDonald well. He used to drive the teenagers to the movies when they dated in high school. And he was pleased when they reconnected in college, though perhaps he wished Colette would have finished college before getting pregnant and marrying. But he was happy because she was happy. She's glowing in her wedding pictures, and Freddie Kassab is beaming like any proud father. And he really did like Jeffrey McDonald. Jeff was an ambitious young man, on his way to becoming a doctor, and Freddie was confident that he would love and take care of his beloved stepdaughter. The couple married within 2 weeks of telling their parents about the pregnancy. Colette dropped out of Skidmore College and moved in with Jeff at Princeton, where their daughter Kimberly was born in April of 1964. The young couple were very much in love, and Jeffrey endeared himself to his in-laws. After 3 more years in married housing at Princeton, he left to attend Northwestern Medical School in Chicago. Their daughter Kristen was born while he was still in med school in May of 1967. After his internship at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in New York City, Jeff joined the Army. He was worried he would be drafted for Vietnam and decided to just volunteer to be a paratrooper. It meant weeks away from Colette and his 2 young daughters, but it would pay off. By the time he moved his family with him to Fort Bragg in North Carolina, he held the rank of captain and was assigned to the Green Berets as group sergeant for the 3rd Special Forces Group. At this time, I'm going to pause for a word from one of our sponsors. Hey guys, I'm so excited to tell you about a new home delivery service I'm using called Care Of. Care Of is a monthly subscription vitamin service that delivers completely personalized vitamin and supplement packs right to your door. They come in convenient daily dosage packets, perfect for travel and making it so much easier to remember to take your vitamins. I keep mine right next to the coffee maker for a quick grab as I'm dashing off to work in the mornings. And if you're anything like me, the vitamin aisle at the drugstore is overwhelming and a bit intimidating. Even after I think I've read up on the best vitamins and supplements for my needs, those endless aisles of choices make me doubt myself. Care Of changed all of that with a simple quiz. You just go to takecareof.com and the quiz only takes 5 minutes. It will ask about your diet, health goals, and lifestyle choices to find out exactly what vitamins and supplements are best suited to your needs. They even offer vegan and vegetarian supplement options, so the company really cares about everyone's dietary needs. Also, one of my favorite things about Care Of is that a portion of every sale goes towards the Good Plus Foundation. Their mission is to break the cycle of family poverty with donated goods and transitional services. For 25% off your first month of personalized Care Of vitamins, visit takecareof.com and enter promo code Southern Fried. That's takecareof.com, and the promo code for Southern Fried listeners is Southern Fried, with no space between the words. Once again, please go to takecareof.com and enter code Southern Fried to get 25% off your first personalized order. You won't regret it. After the McDonalds moved to Fort Bragg, the couple was outwardly happy. But as author Joe McGinnis found in interviews and letters, not all was well with the young couple. They had always been strapped for money. Colette couldn't work with toddlers at home, but of course Jeff remained in school. They felt their sacrifices would be worth it once he was a doctor. Their long-term dream was to own a farmhouse in Connecticut with horses and dogs and at least 3 more children. Eventually, Jeff would stop practicing and teach at a nearby university so he could be with his family. But for now, the married housing at Fort Bragg was much better than the tiny apartments they had dealt with in college with 2 babies. At Fort Bragg, they had a 3-bedroom home and a duplex in married housing on base. It was still small, but they had their own porch, part of a yard, and Jeff finally had a steady paycheck. But it was never enough. There was still financial strain, and Jeff started moonlighting at 2 nearby hospitals. 3 days before the murders, he had signed up for a 3rd hospital. He literally worked all the time. His hours were insane, which, yes, are typical to a lot of doctors, but much worse with the moonlighting and Army schedule. Jeffrey McDonald started doing what a lot of young people at that time were doing, professional or not. using amphetamines. Amphetamines kept him awake and alert on shift, and then at night he would roam the house, hollow-eyed and restless, watching late shows and reading. When Colette found out she was pregnant again before Christmas of 1969, Jeff was palpably disappointed. Colette wrote worriedly to her mother, hoping Jeff would lighten up soon and accept this third blessing. Maybe this time they would get the boy he had always dreamed of. And there were many other tensions in the young marriage. Jeff had cheated on Colette numerous times, and though she publicly said nothing, she suffered the embarrassment privately and tried her best to appear happy and cheerful for the sake of her girls. She also kept trying to better herself. She was taking a course in child psychology at a local community college at the time of her death. Jeff, on the other hand, had told Colette he was asked to accompany the Army boxing team to a competition in Russia for 1 month, leaving her, at which point she would be 7 months pregnant, to care for their children alone. But it was all a complete lie. There was no trip to Russia. He was actually making plans to spend the month in New York City with an old flame he still occasionally hooked up with during his marriage. And it wasn't just the cheating. Jeffrey McDonald put a lot of financial pressure on the family himself. He spent money they really didn't have, insisting on having the best and leaving Colette to figure out how to feed the family when he made impulsive choices like buying the latest high-tech stereo system. He was all about appearances. The Kassabs remembered that Christmas how they came to visit, and Jeff had invited the neighbors over to the already crowded apartment for drinks. He liked to show off his new stereo system, the pony he had just bought for the girls, everything. And it's not that the Kassabs disliked the neighbors, but they were soft-spoken people, and frankly, they were there to visit their family, not be crowded in with neighbors they didn't know. Once Colette had her children, Freddie and Mildred were over the moon for their granddaughters. Mildred later remembered that when Kimberly was born, Colette looked at her and said, "Hey, Mom, here's one of your lost little girls." The Kassabs were loving parents and delighted grandparents. They visited Colette, Jeff, and the kids at Fort Bragg as often as they could. And Freddie's close relationship with Colette was still very special. He often called her on the Watts line from his office, sometimes taping their conversations to play for Mildred when he got home. If you don't know what a Watts line is, it was an early plan of unlimited long distance used by companies in the 60s and 70s. After all, Colette, Kimberly, and Kristen were all in North Carolina with Jeff. Frequent calls to and from Long Island would have been costly. But Freddie made sure they talked as much as possible, and Colette also called home as much as she could. Just 36 hours before the murders, on Sunday evening, the day after Valentine's Day, Colette called her mother and asked if she and the girls could come for a visit. 5 months pregnant, home without a car because Jeff was on a 24-hour shift, Colette sounded blue. She was stuck home in the rain with her two restless little girls, and she really wanted to get away. But Mildred was worried because they were putting in a swimming pool and the backyard was already dug up and unsafe for the children. "Wait until spring," she told her daughter. It would be the last time she talked to her, and it would haunt her for the rest of her life. At this time, I'm going to pause to hear a final word from our sponsors. Before I continue, I'm going to repeat the warning given at the top of the show. This next portion will describe violence against children, and it is very upsetting. Please use discretion. At 3:40 a.m. on February 17, 1970, a Fayetteville phone operator received a call from a man with a very faint voice. He asked that the military police and an ambulance be sent to 544 Castle Drive. The operator asked if that was on base or off, but didn't get an answer. She went ahead and put the call through to the MP headquarters at Fort Bragg. At 3:42, the desk sergeant took the call and heard a man say, "544 Castle Drive, help, 544 Castle Drive, stabbing." Then there was a clunking sound as the caller evidently dropped the receiver. Within 10 minutes, there were four military policemen at the small duplex with red and blue flashing lights, illuminating the raw, drizzling rain. The front door was locked and the blinds were drawn. Everything was dark and silent. A lieutenant tried knocking but got no answer. They were about to radio to ask for permission to break down the door when a sergeant suggested trying the back door. It didn't take long for him to come running back, screaming, "Get Womack ASAP!" Womack was the name of the Fort Bragg base hospital. He had found the back door open and walked into a small utility room. The utility room opened into the master bedroom, where Colette McDonald lay on her back on the floor. She was very obviously dead. Covered in blood, her face was battered, with one eye still open. Even her legs were smeared with blood, and it could be seen on the bottoms of her feet in photos. Her blood-soaked pajamas had once been pink, and there was a blue pajama top draped over her chest. Lying next to her was Jeffrey McDonald. Wearing only blue pajama bottoms, he was lying face down with one arm wrapped around Colette's neck. There was a small paring knife laying on the rug near the dresser, and the bedspread and top sheet were crumpled up and also soaked in blood near the doorway. The MPs noticed with horror that the word pig had been written in blood on the headboard of their bed. Then Jeffrey McDonald started moaning. The MP who ran to his side said he was whispering, "Check my kids, I heard them crying." The MP then ran down the hall and shined a light into the first bedroom he came to. He saw 5-year-old Kimberly McDonald lying on her left side with the covers pulled up to her chin. But there was blood underneath her head, and she had a horrifying gaping wound in her cheek with bone protruding. The MP backed out slowly and stepped into the room on the other side of the hall, the third and final bedroom. He saw with his flashlight the small form of 2-year-old Kristen McDonald, also lying on her left side. Her arm was outstretched close to an almost empty baby bottle. Unlike her mother and sister, her blonde hair and face were untouched, but she was still covered in blood. There was blood soaking into the sheets and mattress and dripping onto the floor. There was a footprint in the blood, leading away from the pool, collecting under Kristen's bed. Back in the master bedroom, Jeffrey McDonald appeared to be struggling to speak. He said, quote, "There were 4 of them. She kept saying, 'Acid is groovy, kill the pigs.' Why did they do this to me? I can't breathe. I need a chest tube." It's the story he would stick to for the rest of his life. After helpfully suggesting a chest tube for himself, he suddenly became dramatic and struggled to push the military police officers away, yelling, "I've got to check my kids." He rallied into an upright sitting position and cried out, quote, "Jesus Christ, look at my wife. I'm going to kill these goddamned acid heads. I don't know why in the hell I fuck with them. I'm not going to help them anymore." The officers told Jeffrey McDonald that they were taking care of his kids and to calm down. He told them his family had been attacked by 2 white men, 1 black man, and a woman wearing a floppy hat. The woman had been holding a candle and doing the chanting about acid being groovy. He also helpfully told the ambulance crew, as they were loading him onto a gurney, that he was probably going into shock and they should elevate his legs, keep him warm, and make sure he didn't swallow his tongue. As they were wheeling him out, he rallied once more, grabbing the doorframe, cursing at the MPs, and saying he wanted to see his kids. But once outside, he immediately calmed down and lay quietly as they loaded him into the ambulance. On the ride to the hospital, he was giving instructions, telling the paramedics that he needed fluids because he was going into shock and was about to pass out. He also reiterated his story about the woman in the floppy hat and said Colette had called to him saying, "Help me, Jeff, help me." The paramedic said he then exclaimed, "My God, she was pregnant." At the emergency room, a nurse put a gauze bandage, not much more substantial than a Band-Aid, over the only wound it would appear that Jeffrey McDonald received. It was a very small cut, right over the area of his left lung. The staff surgeon would later testify that he did have a few minor cuts and scratches and a small bruise on his forehead, which possibly caused a light concussion. The most serious wound Jeffrey suffered was that small cut. A cut the surgeon characterized as a clean, sharp, and small incision. This small wound, did cause his left lung to partially collapse, as shown in a chest X-ray, but he was never in any real danger. His blood pressure was 120 over 70. His pulse was 78. His respiratory rate was 26, and his body temperature was 99. You don't have to be a doctor to know that these are all perfectly normal vital signs. In contrast, his family suffered many gruesome injuries, the kind of injuries you would expect from a rampaging psychotic killer. Colette McDonald had been bludgeoned with 6 blows to her skull, and both of her arms were broken, probably while trying to protect her head. She had also been stabbed 21 times with an ice pick and 16 times with a knife. Kimberly McDonald had also been bludgeoned and was stabbed in the neck about 10 times. It was hard to count her stab wounds as they were actually large gaping wounds. 2-year-old Kristen McDonald was not lucky enough to have been clubbed in the head first. She had been stabbed 33 times with a knife and 16 times with an ice pick in her chest and back. Her little hands were covered in blood, and she had defensive wounds, one almost severing her index finger on her left hand. There is no doubt that she saw her attacker and felt much pain. But at 2 years old, can you even imagine how her poor little mind processed what was happening to her? I apologize for going into so much graphic detail, particularly about the wounds the little girl suffered, but I feel it is very important to note all of their injuries in contrast to Jeffrey McDonald's. None of his wounds even needed stitching. Back at the hospital, the doctors were more concerned with Jeffrey McDonald's emotional well-being than physical condition. He was tearful, yet angry, lashing out at doctors and screaming at and berating the nursing staff. He did ask the ER doctor, "Am I going to be all right, Doc?" And the doctor told him, "Yes, I think you are." Jeffrey then asked, "What about my wife and kids?" The doctor had already been informed that his patient's entire family was murdered. They were all gone. But he didn't want to upset him any further, so he said, "They'll be okay." To which Jeffrey McDonald replied, "What do you mean they'll be okay? They're dead, aren't they?" He also repeated the story of the 4 intruders to the medical staff and went into even more detail, explaining that he had checked on his children before he called for help and they had no pulses. He said that Colette was covered in blood and, quote, "she looked very bad." He then went on to say, quote, "Be sure to tell the MPs and CID that I pulled the knife that was in her chest out. Tell the MPs and CID that I pulled the knife from my wife's chest and threw it on the floor." CID stands for the Criminal Investigation Division of the Army. So at the hospital, Jeffrey McDonald, whose entire family had just been slaughtered and who was barely injured at all, swung from hysterically screaming and crying to calmly explaining what happened to the doctors and making sure they knew he had touched the knife. Note that he also said he knew the girls had no pulses, even though he kept asking where they were and wanting to know why they weren't at the hospital with him. I think this is because he kept slipping up. At this point, he knew they were dead, but was trying to act like he didn't. He was waiting for the dramatic moment a doctor would tell him his family was dead, but it didn't happen that way. Instead, with his only real symptom being diarrhea of the mouth, he kept giving confusing details. 3 different doctors who treated Jeffrey McDonald noted that this hysteria came and went, and it would seem that he knew his family was dead, even though he kept asking about them. He was agitated and combative, pacing the floors until he was given a sedative. Back at the scene, the first investigator, William Ivory, arrived. He had already been briefed on the gruesome attacks, but he was still unprepared for what he saw. He looked briefly at Colette and the girls and then went immediately to the next-door neighbor and called the Fort Bragg CID chief, Franz Grebner. He also asked the neighbor and his family if they had heard anything, any sounds of a break-in, a fight, or anything. They said they had not. Ivory then took the next-door neighbor with him back to the McDonald's home to identify the bodies. The poor man who lived next door quietly said, "Yes, that's Kimmy. Yes, that's Christy. Yes, that's Mrs. McDonald." In response to Ivory's frantic calls, over a dozen CID officers and MPs arrived on scene. This would later be a big point of contention. Officers of every rank were walking through the crime scene until it was finally secured in the daylight hours. Nowadays, this wouldn't happen, even in the smallest of towns. One look and we know it's a crime scene and to not disturb anything. I think it's fair to say that these MPs and CID investigators had never seen anything like this, and certainly didn't follow even the protocol of the times. But CID Chief Grebner felt right away that something was off about the scene. Despite the blood, the home and its furniture were barely disturbed. A coffee table was knocked over in the living room, along with a potted plant, but that was it. That was the entirety of a disturbance shown in a life-and-death struggle between four people and a Green Beret and his wife, who obviously fought desperately for her life. It was difficult to accept, and they didn't accept it. They were suspicious of Jeffrey McDonald right away. How could four supposed hippie druggies best a Green Beret, a man trained in hand-to-hand combat, without at least tearing up the house? By 6 a.m., first light was dawning on this raw, gray, and horrific day, and investigators found three weapons outside. Laying just outside the back door was a blood-stained piece of wood about 2 inches by 3 feet, with two blue threads stuck to it. About 20 feet away, under a bush, were an ice pick and another paring knife. Both had been wiped clean of blood. This paring knife had Old Hickory written on the handle and was confirmed to be from the McDonald kitchen along with the ice pick. The knife that had been found near Colette was a Geneva Forge knife. It's the brand name of a set of butcher knives found in the house. By 8 a.m., they removed the bodies. Kimberly and Kristen's small bodies were placed on one stretcher. Then Colette was carefully moved. William Ivory used a pair of tongs to remove the blue pajama shirt from her chest, along with the bath mat that had been placed on her abdomen. As Ivory removed the blue top, he saw several holes from what he guessed was the ice pick on the back of the shirt. It had also been torn down the middle. He had just watched Jeffrey McDonald be wheeled away earlier, and at this point, he assumed the man must have had numerous stab wounds in his back. As we know, he had no stab wounds. But Ivory immediately sent word to have Captain McDonald questioned while there was still time, not knowing they would have all the time in the world to question him. As they moved Colette's body, they found a huge clot of blood beneath her head. As you can see in crime scene photos, her blonde hair was completely soaked with blood, and the clot under her head was another blue thread. Once he saw this, after Colette's body was taken away, Ivory picked 2 dozen blue threads with tweezers from underneath where she had lain. They appeared to be identical to the blue pajama top that Jeffrey McDonald had been wearing. Finding threads on top of her body would have been more likely, but underneath? Continuing the search, investigators found 81 blue threads spread across the master bedroom. 2 were even found directly below where the word pig had been written in blood. Not far from that, Ivory found 2 pieces of a latex glove. In addition to the blue threads found in the master bedroom, many were found in the girls' bedrooms. 19 pajama fibers were found in Kimberly McDonald's room, with 14 of those fibers found underneath her bed covers. 1 of those fibers were found underneath her pillow. And probably worst of all, 1 of those blue fibers was found under Kristen's fingernail. 2 more were found under her bed covers. Back at the hospital, Jeffrey McDonald was given a chest tube merely as a precautionary measure. He was fine. The next day, he was questioned by CID and FBI agents. They both agreed that he showed little emotion, except the CID agent noticed that he didn't really want to talk about Kristen. Quote, he would talk about his wife and he would talk about the older girl, but he just didn't want to talk about Kristen. Could that be because he struck out at his wife and oldest daughter in anger, but not Kristen? She was not hit with a club. Her murder was brutal and deliberate, but probably the most difficult for him because he wasn't angry at her. Jeffrey McDonald went through the events leading up to the night of the murders. He awoke at 5:25 a.m., showered, and dressed for a 24-hour shift in the ER at Hamlet Hospital, one of his extra jobs, before he went home to shower again at around 6 a.m. Monday morning. He then dressed and returned to base for his shift there. Despite the title of group surgeon, his job was essentially clerical, filling out forms like the monthly venereal disease report. He said that afternoon he played basketball before he went home. He took the girls to see the pony he had bought them for Christmas and then went back to the house. Monday night was the night Colette had her child psychology class, so they had a rushed dinner and then she left for class. He said he put Kristen to bed around 7 p.m. and then showered again and changed into his blue pajamas. He said Kim stayed up watching TV with him and then went to bed around 9. Colette got home from class around 9:45. He said they watched television together while sipping a liqueur. It might sound strange that a doctor was drinking with his pregnant wife, but things were a bit different in 1970. A drink or two wasn't frowned upon, especially a sweet liqueur, which were all the rage at the time. He said when Johnny Carson came on, Colette said she was tired and went to bed. But he said he wasn't tired yet, even though he had worked a 24-hour shift on Sunday into Monday morning before going to work on base. Jeffrey McDonald said that after everyone went to bed, he finished a novel and washed the dinner dishes. Then around 2 a.m., he decided to go to bed, but found Kristen in the bed with Colette. He said she had wet the bed. Instead of waking Kristen or Colette, he said he put Kristen in her own bed and grabbed a blanket and headed back for the couch to sleep. This detail is important because once Jeff claimed it was Kristen, he had to stick to that story, even though it was later proven that the urine in his bed had belonged to Kimberly. I will circle back to this. He said he wasn't sure how long he slept before he was woken by Colette and the girls screaming for him. He claimed that when he opened his eyes, four people were standing over him. A black man in an army jacket, two white guys, one with a mustache and one in a hooded sweatshirt, and of course, the woman wearing the floppy hat. He said she was blonde and was holding a candle saying, "Acid is groovy, kill the pigs, acid and rain." He claims he sat up and began fighting with the intruders. He said the black man hit him in the head with what he felt was a baseball bat, while the others started punching him. He then said he looked down and saw an ice pick. He claims at this point he passed out. And when he came to, the four were gone. Specifically, he said when he woke up he was shivering and that his pajama top was torn and twisted around his wrists. This is another important detail to keep in your back pocket. After this, he claims he went frantically from room to room checking pulses, trying to give mouth to mouth, basically in a state of panic. He saw Colette with a knife in her chest, which he then pulled out and then covered her with his blue pajama top. He said he then looked around to make sure the intruders were gone, and then checked his own injuries in the bathroom before he finally went to the phone. Later, officers would find this phone off the hook and in pristine condition. For a man who had supposedly been running around, checking pulses, and attempting CPR, he didn't leave any blood on the phone. There were a few drops in the bathroom, however, which he would know and was already explaining. I'll also talk more on that later. In addition to the lack of blood where it should have been, there were also no blue fibers from his pajama top where they should have been, if you believe his story. If his shirt was torn on the couch, why were no fibers found there? If he was stabbed on the couch, why didn't they find any blood there? The only blood found in the living room was a smear on a magazine that had been on the coffee table. Interestingly, the Esquire magazine had a long article about the Manson murders. And this is where I'm going to pause the story. In the next episode, I will tell you about the decade of legal wranglings it took to get Jeffrey McDonald to trial. I will also give you my theory on the crime based on the blood evidence, so I will be going step by step through the events of that horrific night. And I will cover his trial and the never-ending appeals. A true narcissist, Jeffrey McDonald has refused to confess, even though it means he will never get out on parole. Southern Fraud True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fraud's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. This episode is brought to you by my Patreon producer, Denise Smiley. Thanks to the generosity of patrons like Denise, I am able to keep growing Southern Fried's production value. As always, if you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. You can also listen directly online from Spreaker, my network, or on their app. I'm also on Stitcher, CastBox, and many other podcatchers. If you're interested in supporting the show, I have a Patreon page with many different rewards for different levels of donation. Or you could visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com, where you can make a one-time donation just by hitting the donate button. If you're interested in Southern Fried gear, I have a merch store open at whatamaneuver.net. Just scroll down the stores until you find the show name. I have t-shirts, tank tops, hoodies, and even onesies for babies. If you have any comments, corrections, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys, and I'm always looking for new cases, so please feel free to reach out. I am also all over social media. Just search the show name in your favorite platform if you would like to connect with me there. And if you're interested in discussing the McDonald case or any other episodes further, come check out my discussion group. It is linked to my Southern Fried True Crime Facebook page. I would love to hear your thoughts. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.